of Lieutenant. Your EDA skill profile and Armada pilot ranking have both been verified. Flight status, authorized. Combat status, authorized. Drone controller station access, granted. User preferences imported. Interceptor synchronization, engaged. Good luck, Lieutenant Lightman. My view screen suddenly switched to a familiar first-person view. From inside an ADI-88 aerospace drone interceptor, prepped for launch. The song You Really Got Me by Van Halen began to blast out of the drone controller station's surround sound system, making me jerk back in my chair. I relaxed as I realized that the computer had just made a Bluetooth connection to my QCOM and automatically started playing the next song on my father's old Raid the Arcade playlist. I didn't hesitate. I hit the launch release, and my interceptor rocketed forward out of its launch tunnel, one of those disguised grain silos, and into the clear blue sky. A real sky filled with real clouds. That was when I realized my view from inside the cockpit was slightly different from the one I was used to seeing when I played Armada. The HUD readouts and targeting reticle were identical, but they were superimposed over a live high-definition video feed of my drone's surroundings, seen from the stereoscopic camera mounted inside the real drone interceptor I was now piloting. With the door of my drone controller station closed, the illusion of being inside an actual cockpit was almost total. I could even see the fang-like tips of its sun guns protruding from the ship in front of me. A split second later, my view of the sky was filled with another familiar sight. A swarm of Glaive fighters firing in all directions, including directly at me. Thanks to Lex's prodding, mine was the first interceptor drone to be launched, which meant I was also currently the only aerial target for the enemy. As I banked to take evasive action, I got my first glimpse of the landscape below. The farmhouses, barns, and silos. Everything was on fire, including the ground itself, which had already been scorched black by sweeping laser fire from above. According to my HUD, there were exactly 100 Glaive fighters attacking the base. And this time it's for real, Zach. If you don't stop them, you die. I had to make a few adjustments to my controller setup, but it only took seconds because the interface was so familiar. Then I took a deep breath and scanned the field of battle. Down below me, other interceptor drones were beginning to rocket up out of the open tops of rows of disguised launch tunnels along the farm's northern edge, all of which were now on fire. Hundreds of Aethids and several Sentinel mechs were beginning to stream out of the underground bunkers concealed beneath the flaming barns and utility buildings nearby. My HUD confirmed that the lone Sentinel running out in front, leading the charge, was being operated by Lex. Her call sign and rank were superimposed over her mech on my display. I watched as she launched her Sentinel into a power leap while simultaneously unloading both of its wrist cannons at a line of Glaive fighters as they zoomed overhead, strafing the ground on either side of her drone with laser fire. I banked my interceptor around and scanned the sky directly over the base. Most of the Glaive fighters appeared to be focusing their attacks on the entrance, those two large armored doors set into the earth, which were already starting to glow red and warp under the intense barrage of laser fire and plasma bombs. Once they made it through those doors, they would storm down the base and rain molten fire down on everything, killing me and Lex and everyone else inside Crystal Palace. But I didn't feel uncertain or afraid. I'd been preparing for this moment my whole life, since the first time I ever picked up a video game controller. I knew what had to be done. I pulled back on my flight stick and firewalled the throttle, launching my drone into the mass of Glaive fighters swarming across the sky directly in front of it. My HUD highlighted the ship closest to my position, and I took a bead on it, leading the target just enough to compensate for its speed and distance before I squeezed the trigger, firing off a sustained burst from my sun guns, scoring two direct hits. The first knocked out the Glaive fighter's shields, and the second destroyed it in a brilliant fireball a millisecond later. Unbeknownst to me, I had just scored the first enemy kill of the battle and the war. After that, though, things began to go downhill. 12. The Battle of Crystal Palace, as it came to be known, was my first taste of real life-or-death combat. Even though I wasn't physically inside my interceptor, my body was only a few hundred yards away, somewhere deep within the underground base I was fighting to protect. If the aliens managed to breach our surface defenses and get inside, I would be killed, along with Lex, the Admiral, and everyone else. I wasn't going to let that happen. I also wasn't going to wait around until Red Jive got his or her drone launched and then proceeded to steal all the glory. I cleared my throat. "Tack," I said, "are you there?" I expected to hear the default synthesized female voice respond, but to my surprise, the system had also imported my customized Armada sound profile, so I heard a familiar soundbite from Flight of the Navigator instead.
"Compliance,"
my TAC said, using its digitized version of Paul Rubin's faux computer voice.
"How may I assist you, Lieutenant Lightman?"
"Engage autopilot," I said, tapping the screen of my tactical display. I dragged my finger across it, indicating an S-shaped trajectory through the highest concentration of enemy fighters. "Take me right into the middle of that mess. You fly, I'll shoot."
"Compliance!"
Now that I was in a real battle, my Flight of the Navigator sound profile seemed inappropriate and distracting, so I switched back to the default female, which, fun fact, had been recorded by the actress Candace Bergen. Chaos Terrain had spared no expense. With the autopilot engaged, I changed my controller configurations so that my throttle and flight stick now functioned as dual joystick multi-axis firing controls for the interceptor's omnidirectional laser turret. As I did so, the turret's three-dimensional targeting system activated, highlighting the enemy ships around me in an ever-widening spiral of overlapping red targeting brackets. "Hello, fish," I whispered, reciting an old incantation. "Welcome to my barrel." TAC piloted my interceptor along the corkscrewing arc I'd laid out, plunging it directly into the enemy's chaotic midst. A swirling whirl of highlight targets appeared on my HUD overlay. I cranked my music up even louder, took a bead on one of the leaders, and opened fire. To my surprise, I managed to take out 7 enemy ships in rapid succession, with precise sustained bursts from my laser turret, before any of them even had time to take evasive action. Then the other ships on my HUD broke from their attack formations and scattered in all directions, all while firing back at me, or where my interceptor had been a millisecond earlier. Just as I'd planned, when my interceptor passed directly through the center of the enemy's symmetrical gauntlet, their ships were caught in their own crossfire for 2 or 3 glorious seconds, resulting in the destruction of at least a dozen more of their fighters. Then, as if controlled by some hive mind, they all ceased their friendly fire in unison, allowing my drone to escape and slip out the other side. I'd executed this maneuver hundreds of times in simulated Armada dogfights, and if I got the timing just right, it always worked like a charm, because the enemy ships reacted to it the same way every single time, the way video game enemies often tend to do. But why would the same tactics work now in the real world? If these were real alien attack drones under the control of sentient beings living in the subsurface oceans of Europa 500 million kilometers away, why would they fly and fight exactly like their video game counterparts? How could Chaos Terrain have been able to simulate the enemy's maneuvers and tactics with such a high level of precision and accuracy? That shouldn't be possible, unless the European drones were being controlled by some form of artificial intelligence or some sort of linked hive mind, instead of being piloted by individual sentient beings. My interceptor took a glancing hit to its shields, and a warning klaxon sounded, drawing all of my attention back to the battle. The haptic feedback system in my chair vibrated to simulate the impact of the enemy plasma bolts against my shields, and I watched their strength indicator bar decrease by half. I highlighted another course on my tactical display and tapped the commit icon.
"Affirmative," Tack said calmly as the computer pulled us into a steep climb.
On my HUD, I saw a long chain of enemy glaives converge on my tail and arc upward to follow me. My laser turret had already drained most of my power core's reserves, so I switched back to my sun guns, then swung my targeting reticle over the leader, taking careful aim. I closed one eye, took a breath, held it, and then fired, and fired again and again. Boom! Kaboom! Boom! Three more glaives exploded brilliantly in front of me, one after the other, just as I'd seen their video game counterparts do countless times before, from the safety of my suburban bedroom. And I heard the words of a young Luke Skywalker echo in my mind. It'll be just like Beggar's Canyon back home. I nailed another glaive, and then another. I was on fire. Everything about the way these glaive fighters were moving and attacking was familiar, in some ways even predictable. And it still felt too easy. Like many fictional alien bad guys, the Sobrakai fighters I'd faced off against in Armada had always suffered from stormtrooper syndrome. They couldn't aim for shit, and they were way too easy to kill. But those had been fictional aliens in a video game. These were real extraterrestrial ships in a real-life battle. So why did the same tactics still work? I mouthed the lyrics to the Queen song playing on my headset as I blasted one glaive after another right out of the sky. And another one gone, another one gone, another one bites the dust. I took out three more glaives with a volley of plasma bolts, bringing my total kills up to 17. According to the mission timer on my HUD, my interceptor had only been in the sky for 73 seconds. Then, just as I was beginning to feel invincible, my ship took a series of direct hits from behind and my shields failed completely. Warning indicators began to flash on my HUD as TAC put my interceptor into an evasive barrel roll and we swooped in low over the base. The ground below was already littered with the burning skeletal remains of hundreds of downed aethids. I zeroed in on one that was legless and decapitated, but still flailing and firing its guns blindly at the sky. Then its operator finally activated the drone's self-destruct sequence, and the detonation caused one of the flaming buildings nearby to collapse. A rapid series of piercing shrieks, each followed by what sounded like a brief thunderclap, erupted from the surround sound speakers lining the walls, floor, and ceiling of my drone controller station. It was a sound I knew well from playing Armada, EDA surface-to-air cannons being fired. During the game's online co-op missions, I'd learned to react to this sound by checking for friendly fire, because the players relegated to operating surface guns during these battles were usually those with the worst aim. I tilted my ship starboard and scanned the ground below, tracking the sound to its source. Several long concealed trenches had opened in the terrain surrounding the farm on all sides. They were each lined with dozens of anti-aircraft plasma cannons and surface-to-air laser turrets. Each of them was already moving and firing in its own unique pattern, and I knew these guns must now be under the control of other Earth Defense Alliance recruits like me, who were also fighting for their lives from a darkened drone controller station somewhere deep underground. I reoriented my tactical display to a two-dimensional view, and it instantly reminded me of the classic arcade game Missile Command. Squadrons of glaive fighters were making repeated swooping attacks on the armored blast doors set into the surface, diving toward them in tight groups of four and five, raining plasma bombs as they came, while also trying to evade the steady barrage of fire from the base's surface guns with only marginal success. The number of enemy ships was already beginning to dwindle, and they were coming under more fire every second as an intermittent stream of reserve interceptor drones continued to emerge from the grain silo launch tunnels and join the fight. Infantry reserves were beginning to arrive, too. New aethids and sentinels were pouring out of their underground bunkers in a steady stream, firing their weapons at the invaders as they came. My shields were coming back up now, so I deactivated the autopilot and nosed my interceptor over into a spiraling dive, attempting to engage another squadron of glaive fighters as they arced down to make another carpet-bombing run on the already red-hot blast doors, which were now beginning to warp and buckle in their massive earthen frame, creating gaps along their edges that were growing wider every second. Soon, they'd be wide enough for a fighter to get inside, and that was all it would take. I adjusted my ship's angle of approach and closed in on the Glaive squadron from above, swinging my targeting reticle over with their silhouettes on my HUD. I thumbed my weapon selector and armed my interceptor's Macross missile pod, but just as I was about to fire it, my targets stopped firing and accelerated their dive. For a split second, I was certain all five of them were going to crash into one of the blast doors in some sort of kamikaze run, but then I realized that they weren't going to impact on the doors. They were aiming for a spot several dozen yards away near the center of the farm, near a cluster of our remaining infantry drones, which were already scattering to get out of their way. But the squadron slid to an abrupt halt just before impact, then began to hover a few feet above the ground. In the space of a few seconds, the five Glaive fighters turned and rotated themselves into a star-shaped formation so that their wingtips barely touched, linking themselves together in a circular chain. Then the curved, blade-like wings of the five Glaive fighters began to interlock and merge with each other, rapidly combining and then reconfiguring to form a single giant humanoid robot, roughly the same size as one of our own sentinels, like a makeshift basilisk. The giant junkyard golem began to bound across the solitary paved road leading up to the isolated farmhouse facade, uprooting the line of utility poles adjacent to it, until the power line snapped across its chest like Godzilla. Tines of electricity briefly erupted across its shambling torso, but that didn't slow its progress. It kept on coming as other glaives began to combine and make landfall behind it. That was when I stopped feeling cocky and started feeling afraid. Terrified, really. None of the Sobrakai ships had ever exhibited behavior like this in Armada or Terra Firma. This was something new. Nearby squadrons of Aethids and Sentinels were already converging on the threat, scrambling to attack this new enemy in their midst. "You've got to be kidding me!" I heard a female voice shout over the open comlink channel. It was Lex. "Since when did these things learn how to form into Voltron?" She said something else after that, but her voice was drowned out by the chainsaw-like roar of her Sentinel's Gauss guns as she unloaded both of them at the thing. Hearing Lex's voice seemed to remind all of the other drone operators that they had access to a comlink, too, because the public channel was suddenly flooded with overlapping voices. Several of them were ground troops, screaming for more air support, as the giant five-glaive mech thing began to wade through their comparatively Lilliputian ranks, strafing them with plasma bolts from the photon cannons that bristled on each of its armored limbs. Blue flame roared from the thrusters at its feet as it flexed its knees and leapt forward, propelling itself 100 meters across the burning landscape toward the base's massive armored blast doors, which had both warped and buckled free of their frame, creating huge gaps along their edges, several of which looked wide enough to allow the giant alien mech to squeeze through and get inside. I scanned the wave of Aethids and Sentinels storming across the landscape below me. Each operator's call sign was superimposed over the drone they were controlling on my HUD, but it still took me several seconds to locate Lex. She was power-leaping toward the newly assembled Glaive mechs, but her drone and those around her were fighting through a hail of plasma fire from above as the remaining Glaive squadron swooped in to lay down cover fire for their comrades on the surface. I jinked my ship down and to the left, joining a line of interceptors beginning an attack run on the remaining mass of Glaives. We rocketed straight into their midst, unloading everything we had at them. I nailed at least 2 enemy fighters myself and saw at least 12 more get bullseyed by my comrades in the space of as many seconds, but we lost several of our interceptors during the charge. Down on the surface, I saw Lex's Sentinel overtake the lead Glaive mech. The 2 towering opponents began to grapple with each other at the edge of the widest breach in the blast doors. The Sentinel executed an impressive move, spinning counterclockwise and bringing up one of its massive arms in a clothesline maneuver that knocked the enemy mech's leg completely off of its hodgepodge torso. Lex power jumped her Sentinel clear of it just before 2 other Sentinels unloaded on the immobilized metal beast. This barrage was joined by hundreds of Aethids who began to fire on it too. Within seconds, the 5 Glaive mech exploded, raining wreckage and debris down onto the smoking blast doors, which pinged and clanged as each piece impacted on it. I swung my interceptor up and around again, intending to make another pass at the remaining glaives. But then I scanned my HUD and saw that only 5 glaive fighters remained, a small cluster of green triangles on my tactical display, moving into some kind of attack formation high above me. I angled my ship toward the remaining squadron, just in time to see them all simultaneously turn into a sharp dive, streaking straight down toward the base, as if they intended to make one final kamikaze run. But it looked to me like their angle was wrong. They weren't diving toward the breach in the warped blast doors. Instead, they were descending toward the long row of interceptor launch tunnels nearby, the ones that had been disguised as grain silos until a few minutes ago. Now, most of that false exterior was burned and blasted away, leaving nothing but scarred armor plating underneath. The diving line of glaive fighters began to spread out, each one lining up with a different launch tunnel. And each of those tunnels, which, I suddenly realized, were all sitting wide open at their tops, led directly down into the drone reserve hangar. According to the diagram on my HUD, that hangar was deep inside the base, not too far from where I was currently sitting. They intended to make a final kamikaze run into the base, through the open mouths of those drone launch tunnels. The simulated alien invaders in Armada had never tried this move. How had the rocket scientists who designed this base not seen this massive hole in its defenses? Luckily, I happened to be there to save the day. I jammed my throttle forward and moved to swing in above them, firing my weapons before I was even within range. I got lucky and took 2 of them out. Then, a few of the other interceptors loitering nearby finally began to fire on them too, taking out 2 more of the enemy ships just before they reached the open mouths of the launch tunnels. But the last remaining glaive fighter managed to get through, and I continued to pursue it as it rocketed downward, closing in on the row of launch silos jutting up from the charred and blackened earth like a row of skeletal fingers.
Attention, all interceptor pilots, this is Palace Command!
Admiral Vance's familiar voice barked over the comlink.
Disengage and cease fire! Do not attempt to pursue that ship into the launch tunnels! I repeat, disengage and cease fire! We have automatic security fail-safes in place that will...
I muted the Admiral's voice on my comlink. On my tactical display, I saw the wing of interceptors trailing me break off and disengage, just as Vance had instructed. And for a brief second, I almost did the same. The years I'd spent playing Armada had conditioned me to follow orders, and Vance's orders in particular, because the game's mechanics rewarded officer obedience. But that had been in a video game, and this was real life, and the Admiral's last-minute order to break off my pursuit seemed like certain suicide. If I didn't destroy this last remaining glaive fighter before it reached the other end of the launch tunnel, nothing would prevent it from overloading its power core inside the drone hangar. The detonation could cause the entire underground base to collapse in on itself, killing me and Lex and everyone else inside before any of us got our big chance to save the world. I wasn't willing to take that risk, or to trust my life to the same moronically designed automatic security failsafe that had just allowed this massive enemy breach in our defenses. So I made the snap decision to disobey a direct order and continued to pursue the kamikaze glaive as it made its nosedive down through the silo's open mouth and into the launch tunnel beyond it, ignoring the insistent, looping voice of Master Yoda in my head.
Told you I have. Regret this, you will.
We both streaked farther through the narrow launch tunnel, like one bullet chasing another down the barrel of a gun, both headed the wrong direction. Just as I was about to open fire on the enemy ship again, it turned into a barrel roll and began to scrape the bladed edge of its right wingtip against the tunnel wall, and I pitched clockwise to dodge the shower of sparks it threw up in its wake. Once I righted myself, I managed to get the glaive back in my sights for a moment, and I fired a short burst at it with my sun guns, but they glanced off its shields, and it kept right on trucking. Meanwhile, overfiring my weapons had caused my drone to decelerate in speed, so the glaive had increased its lead, making it even more difficult for me to get a bead on it. It reminded me of playing Space Invaders. The last alien alive was always the bitch of the bunch, and the hardest to kill, because it moved faster than all of the others. Was it just my imagination, or did this glaive suddenly seem a whole lot harder to kill than all of its cannon fodder brethren? I had to stop firing for a second to focus on keeping my interceptor from crashing into the tunnel walls as I inched my speed back up, trying to get the enemy back in my sights. Its metal hull glinted up ahead as the pulsing collision lights embedded in the concrete walls of the shaft streaked past in a neon blur. The power in my interceptor was nearly depleted. Soon, I would have to choose between firing and keeping up. I only had enough juice for a couple sun gun shots. As our two ships continued to hurtle downward in a diving chase, I saw the tunnel begin to broaden slightly, and I fired another burst from my sun guns. But it didn't connect, and my cockiness now turned to panic, because the lone glaive had just cleared the tunnel and come out the other side, zooming on into the cavernous drone hangar. I followed it inside and then slammed on my interceptor's inertia brakes because it appeared that I now had my enemy cornered. I continued firing plasma bolts at the glaive, and shooting from a standstill drastically improved my aim. I scored two direct hits on its shields in rapid succession, causing them to flicker and then fail. The second the glaive's shields dropped, it slid to an instantaneous stop out ahead of me, near the hangar's cavernous center. I'd seen glaive fighters and EDA interceptors execute this maneuver countless times while playing Armada. I'd executed it plenty of times myself. The drone had just initiated its self-destruct sequence. Its reactor core would overload in approximately 7 seconds. I fired a last volley of plasma bolts at the unprotected enemy ship, which was already vibrating from the buildup of power in its reactor core, and held my breath as they streaked toward it, silently praying to Krom that they would reach the glaive and destroy it before it finished transforming itself into a weapon of mass destruction. Time seemed to stop. I caught a second-long glimpse of the hangar around us and noticed that it was still over half full. Thousands of brand-new, unused interceptors were nestled into belt-fed launch racks that lined the hangar's curved, reinforced concrete walls. I watched in slow motion as the shots I'd fired closed in on the glaive's quivering metal hull. They finally seemed to reach their mark at last, and I saw a blinding white flash across my cockpit's wraparound screens. Then they all went black, and my entire drone controller station powered down, throwing the tiny room into total darkness. Somewhere above me, I heard the muffled atomic boom of a power core detonation, followed by a horrible rumbling that could only be several levels of the base collapsing in on each other. I don't know how long I sat there in the pitch-black darkness, listening to the aftermath of my mistake. But at some point, the door of my controller station hissed open, and a terrible flood of light poured in, momentarily blinding me. As my eyesight slowly returned, I saw a female silhouette resolve in the doorway. Lex was standing there, with one hand cocked on her hip. "Did you see what happened?" she said, shaking her head. "Some moron interceptor pilot chased that last glaive fighter into one of the launch tunnels right before the whole hangar went up." I nodded and got to my feet unsteadily. Then I stepped out of my control pod, feeling almost as if I'd just emerged from a real interceptor and a real battle, which, of course, I had. "I'm still not even sure what happened up there," I lied. "We'd already won," she said. "We'd just destroyed all but one of their drones. But then somehow the last glaive fighter got inside the drone hangar before it self-destructed," she said. "Somebody screwed up." When I didn't respond, she studied my face for a moment. "It was you, wasn't it?" she said. "Didn't you hear Admiral Vance screaming at you to break off over the comlink? Everyone else sure did." She pursed her lips and gave me two thumbs up. Before I could begin to formulate my defense, my QCOM beeped and vibrated against my forearm. Then its display began flashing red to get my attention. A text message appeared, ordering me to report to Admiral Vance in the command center. An interactive map of the base below it appeared, and a green path lit up, leading from my current location in the drone controller hub out into the corridor outside, then down to another bank of elevators. Just as I finished reading the message, that synthesized female voice spoke over the base PA system.
"Lieutenant Zach Lightman, you are ordered to report to Admiral Vance in the command center on level 3 immediately."
As Lex stepped aside to clear my path, she softly sang,
"You're in trouble."
13. The three-dimensional map on my QCOM took me on a circuitous multi-level route through the base. It seemed to be detouring me around the sections most heavily damaged by the hangar explosion, but I still saw signs of its aftermath everywhere. As I made my way down half-collapsed corridors filled with smoke and sparking electrical fires, several Aethid emergency response teams marched past me, coming the other direction. I also saw a few of my fellow drone operators, many of them covered in dust or ash. Some shuffled along like zombies, while others ran past me in hysterics. At every turn, I expected to see a corpse, someone who had died because of me. The dreamlike euphoria I'd felt during my arrival here had now completely subsided, replaced with a cocktail of confusion, uncertainty, and most of all, doom. When I passed through the security doors leading into the Crystal Palace Command Center, the two guards at the entrance seemed to know who I was and what I was doing there. In fact, it seemed as if everyone who saw me fixed me with a withering glare, but I glared back at each of them defiantly. When I finally reached Admiral Vance's office, I paused outside in the corridor and practiced saluting a few times, mimicking the way I'd seen soldiers do it in the movies. Then I took a deep breath and pressed my hand to the scanner plate on the wall. A tone sounded and the doors slid open. With some effort, I stepped inside, and the doors hissed shut again behind me. Admiral Vance was sitting behind his desk, but he stood up when I walked in. I halted just inside the entrance and gave him the amateur salute I'd just finished rehearsing. He surprised me by straightening his posture and returning it, raising a rigid right hand to his brow in a blur, then dropping it like the blade of a guillotine a half second later. That was when I noticed the sidearm on his right hip, an old-fashioned 9mm Beretta. I was pretty sure he hadn't been wearing it earlier in the briefing auditorium. I lowered my salute, but made sure to remain at rigid attention while doing my best to avoid making direct eye contact with the Admiral, which was surprisingly difficult considering he was only rocking one eye. The Admiral let the silence wear on, and I realized that he was waiting for me to speak first. "Lieutenant Zach Lightman," I said, clearing my throat. "Reporting is ordered, sir."
"At ease, Lieutenant," the Admiral replied,
sounding surprisingly calm.
"Sit."
He motioned to a metal chair beside his desk. As he took his own seat, the Admiral reached over to shut off one of the computer monitors arrayed around his desk in a semicircle. But, just before the screen went dark, I caught a glimpse of what was displayed on it. The same mugshot that was on my EDA security badge was clearly visible at the top, along with my senior yearbook photo and a lot of densely packed text. All of my private information, including my school records. Before I'd walked into his office, the Admiral had been skimming my entire life story, and he'd made no effort to conceal this from me.
"You had quite a first day, Mr. Lightman," he said. "You're going to be the first recruit in EDA history to be court-martialed less than an hour after they enlisted," he smiled. "You might make the Guinness Book of World Records, provided it still exists after tomorrow."
"Admiral, sir, I'm still not even sure what it was I did wrong," I said, and that was mostly true. "I was trying to stop that ship from getting inside the base before it self-destructed. What did you expect me to do?"
"To follow orders, Lieutenant," the Admiral said,
and I thought I finally detected a hint of anger in his voice. He tapped a key on his computer and his display screen lit up. He clicked his mouse a few times and my interceptor appeared on the monitor, turning into a steep dive to pursue the last remaining Glaive fighter as it streaked down into the open mouth of the drone launch tunnel while the Admiral shouted over the comlink,
"Disengage and cease fire! Do not attempt to pursue that ship into the launch tunnels! I repeat, disengage and cease fire!"
"Hey, you skipped right over all the footage of me kicking ass," I protested. "Can't we watch a little of that? You know, for context?" The Admiral ignored me. The clip cut to another camera angle, which showed the last Glaive fighter as it emerged from the opposite end of the drone launch tunnel and entered the hangar with my ship close on its tail, still firing at it. The Admiral paused the footage again.
"I issued that order for a good reason, Lieutenant,"
he said calmly. If you'd followed it and broken off your pursuit, an armored safety blockade would have locked into place over that launch tunnel at both ends, preventing the enemy ship from flying into it. Like this, see?
On another monitor, the Admiral pointed to an animated wireframe graphic that showed a Glaive fighter approaching the launch tunnel's open mouth. But just before it got there, a thick circular disc slammed into place, covering the launch tunnel's entrance. A second later, the enemy ship crashed into it and exploded in a simulated fireball.
But that's not what happened, is it? The Admiral said. Because you ignored my order and continued to pursue the enemy ship at close range, the transponder inside your interceptor disabled the tunnel's safety blockades to allow its safe passage. Unfortunately, this also allowed the Glaive fighter you were chasing to do the very same thing. Thanks to you, it was able to breach our defenses and enter our drone hangar, where it promptly detonated its reactor core.
He hit play on the footage again, and I watched in silence as the Glaive fighter completed its self-destruct sequence and detonated.
Bravo, Iron Beagle,
the Admiral said, giving me a sarcastic round of applause.
By some miracle, no personnel were killed in that explosion, he said. But we lost over 500 brand-new ADI-88 interceptors.
I winced. That was a lot. I did shoot down more enemy fighters than any of the other pilots, I said.
True, he replied. But your little screw-up did more damage to this base than the enemy's sneak attack managed to.
He frowned at me.
Whose side are you on?
I didn't have a response for that. The even-tempered disappointment in his voice was somehow far worse than the Full Metal Jacket-style bawling out I'd expected.
Those drones took years to build, at a cost of millions, he said. But that's just money. To humanity, they were priceless, since we've run out of time to build any more of them.
But, sir, how was I supposed to know about those automatic security blockades? I said. That was never a part of the game. In Armada, the Sobrakai never tried to fly one of their fighters into an EDA base through its drone launch tunnels.
That's because we didn't think there was any way for the enemy's fighters to get past the launch tunnel security blockades, he sighed. Apparently, no one believed one of our own pilots would be dumb enough to tail an enemy ship, making a suicide run into our drone hangar.
It's not fair to pin that on me, I shot back. I've never even been in combat before, and I never wanted to be. You brought me here and told me we were being invaded by aliens about 10 minutes before they attacked this fucking place. I'm a high school kid. I'm supposed to be in school right now. The Admiral nodded, raising both hands in a calming gesture.
You're right, he said. I apologize. This isn't your fault, he smirked. Not entirely.
His answer threw me. I didn't respond.
The EDA always knew the risks of using a video game simulation as the sole method of training civilian recruits, he said. But under the circumstances, there was no other option. It was the only way to locate and train millions of average people to operate combat drones in a short period of time without anyone knowing it. Your act of insubordination today, and its disastrous aftermath, are inevitable results of putting an unstable, undisciplined civilian like you on the front lines. But you're one of our most gifted pilots, so in your case, I was told the benefits would outweigh the risks.
He let out a weary sigh.
Obviously, that turned out not to be the case.
He paused, giving me another chance to speak up in my own defense. I didn't take it.
If you act without thinking in an Armada dogfight, there are no real consequences, he went on. Your player ranking drops a few places, and the game gives you a canned cutscene lecture that you promptly ignore. He leaned forward. But things have changed. This isn't a game anymore. We can't afford any more mistakes like the one you just made. Understood?
So, does this mean you're not going to court-martial me?
Of course not, Vance said. We need you, Lieutenant. Once the European Armada begins to arrive, we're going to need every able-bodied human being on Earth to take up arms and help us fight them off. And that may still not be enough.
His gaze drifted back up to the countdown clock mounted on the wall above his desk, and mine followed. 7 hours, 2 minutes, and 11 seconds remaining. I glanced down at my QCOM and saw the countdown mirrored there. It was hard to believe the attack and subsequent battle had all occurred in less than an hour. I watched the seconds tick off.
"But this was your first and only warning," the Admiral said. "You screw up like this again, you'll be flying a cargo plane full of rubber dog shit out of Hong Kong."
I stared at him in surprise. He glared back at me for several seconds, then gave me an almost imperceptible smile. I suddenly realized who I was talking to. Admiral Vance was also Viper, the Armada pilot currently ranked in fourth place, just above Rostam. Viper was also the name of a character in Top Gun, the film he'd just quoted. Until now, I hadn't known that Viper and Admiral Vance were the same guy. This little detail had yet to be revealed in Armada's ongoing storyline, which now seemed to have spilled over into reality. The Admiral was still staring at me, waiting for a response. His grin was gone.
"Do we understand each other, son?"
I winced at the Admiral's choice of words. "Yes, sir," I said through clenched teeth.
"But I'm not your son."
He stared at me for a moment. Then he smiled and nodded.
"I know," he said. "You're Xavier Lightman's kid."
We locked eyes.
"You look just like him," the Admiral said, matter-of-factly. "You fly like him, too."
The office seemed to be spinning now, whirling around me with increasing velocity. "You knew my father?" I finally managed to ask.
"I still know him," he said. He pointed to his QCOM. "I just spoke with General Lightman before you arrived in my office. We talked about you, naturally."
The words fell on me like an avalanche. Since I was a boy, I had imagined countless absurd scenarios in which my father had somehow faked his own death, or lost his memory, or been kidnapped by the CIA and brainwashed into becoming an assassin like Jason Bourne. But the fantasies had been just that, fantasies. I'd never really doubted that he was dead, not until this moment. "My father is dead," I said hollowly. "He didn't live to see my first birthday."
"Your father's alive," the Admiral said. He reached up to touch the jagged scar on his right cheek. "And I owe him my life. We all do."
My mind kept rejecting that any of this was even possible. That any of this was really happening. My father wasn't just alive, but a general in the Earth Defense Alliance? A war hero tasked with saving the world? I opened my mouth, but Vance seemed to anticipate my next question before I asked it.
"The EDA faked your father's death when he was first recruited. All our early recruits were forced to cut off all contact with their old lives. In return, the EDA promised to take measures to help support each of their families financially while they were off saving the world."
So my father had knowingly and willingly deceived and abandoned us. How could he have? Admiral Vance cut into my thoughts again.
"Try not to be angry at your father. He did it to protect you, to protect the world. And don't feel too sorry for yourself, either. Your family wasn't the only one that had to make sacrifices."
He glanced down at the wedding ring on his left hand.
"Trust me, Zach. Your father never forgot about you. He was actually kind of a crybaby over how much he missed you, to be honest." He studied me. "And even though you weren't aware of it, he actually re-entered your life several years ago, albeit in a very limited way. General Lightman has been supervising your training ever since the Armada simulation first went online," Vance said. "He took part in nearly all of your training missions. He also happens to be Armada's highest-ranking pilot, His call sign, Red Jive, I blurted out. My father is the Red Baron? The Admiral nodded. Is he here? I asked, glancing behind me, wondering if he was about to walk in. When can I see him? I jumped to my feet. I want to talk to him right now. Calm down, Lieutenant, he said. The General isn't stationed here at the palace. He flipped open a clear plastic folder on his desk and handed me the single sheet of paper inside. It appeared to be some kind of office memo printed on Earth Defense Alliance stationery. My full name, rank, and other vital statistics were printed neatly across the top, followed by several lines of text that contained a lot of abbreviations and acronyms I didn't recognize. The Admiral's name and signature were at the bottom. What is this? I asked, still trying to decipher the text. Your orders, he said, along with your duty station assignment. A digital copy has also been sent to your QCOM. I looked up at him. I'm not staying here? He shook his head. Most of Crystal Palace's personnel are being relocated to other outposts as we speak, he said. The location of this base is obviously no longer a secret to the enemy, if it ever was to begin with. Besides, as you know, nearly all of our remaining aerial drones were destroyed when the reserve hangar went up. I continued to scan my orders, trying to figure out where I was being sent. Then I saw it, printed near the top. Duty Station Assignment, MBA, Lunar DCS. No way. You're sending me to Moonbase Alpha? He nodded. It's really up there? I asked. The EDA really built a secret defense base in a crater on the far side of the moon. Just like in the game? Yes, Lightman, he said. Just like in the game. Try to keep up. His QCOM buzzed on the desk in front of him, and he checked its display. Then he spun around in his chair and began to study the half-dozen display screens arrayed behind him. That will be all, Lieutenant, he said. He pointed to the exit. Get your uniform and report to the shuttle bay immediately. I stared back at him, not moving. I'm not going anywhere until you let me see my father, sir. Can't you read, Lieutenant? He said. He's your new commanding officer. I glanced back down at the printout in my hand. There it was, printed just below my duty station. CO, Jen Lightman, X. Give your old man my best when you get to the far side of the moon, Admiral Vance said, in a voice that suddenly sounded light years away. And tell him we're even. The map on my QCOM's display screen led me back through the undamaged sections of the base down to level 4. When I stepped off of one of the turbo elevators that was still operational, I joined the procession of recruits filing into the new recruit induction center, an enormous carpeted room filled with a maze of high-walled office cubicles. It reminded me of the DMV offices in Portland, although, thanks Zod, the line here appeared to be moving much more quickly. When I reached the front of it, a uniformed technician gave my retinas another scan. Then he retrieved a crisp new EDA flight officer's uniform from the long rack behind him and presented it to me, on a hanger draped in clear plastic, along with a pair of black running shoes with dark gray soles, Velcro laces, and no manufacturer's logo anywhere on them. The two-piece EDA uniform was dark blue, and its zippered jacket had gold piping along the shoulders and down each sleeve. My name and rank were stitched over the jacket's left breast pocket, above the Earth Defense Alliance insignia. I filed into the adjacent changing rooms, then found an empty stall and got undressed. After I finished stuffing my civilian clothes into my backpack, I put my EDA uniform on. Everything was just my size. I avoided looking in the mirror until I was finished, then turned to face my reflection. I hadn't worn a uniform since Cub Scouts, and I was concerned that this one might look equally unflattering on me. But when I checked my profile in the mirror, I thought I actually looked pretty sharp. Like an intrepid young space hero about to embark on an epic adventure. Then I realized that was more or less my new job description. I stared at my face in the mirror.
taking in the strange mix of fear and anticipation battling each other for supremacy there. Then I straightened my uniform one last time, picked up my backpack, and exited the dressing room, feeling several inches taller now than when I'd first stepped inside. The map on my QCOM directed me back through the base, again highlighting a circuitous route that took me around the areas damaged during the enemy's sneak attack. When I reached the shuttle bay, I was surprised to see that, aside from some rocky debris scattering the runway, it seemed to have escaped the attack, and my monumental screw-up, unscathed. Several EDA shuttles were parked on numbered landing pads around the perimeter of the hangar's oval-shaped runway, and I walked down the line until I spotted the one specified in my orders. Its cabin doors were open, and through them I could see that several people were already sitting on board, waiting for departure.
"Look at you," I heard a female voice say behind me. "An officer and a gentleman."
I turned to see Lex, standing at rigid attention in her new EDA uniform, which looked as if it had been tailored to accentuate her frame.
"Well," she said, "what do you think?"
"I think you might be the girl of my dreams, and I'll probably never see you again."
That was what I was thinking, but I couldn't bring myself to say it out loud, so instead I took a step, straightened my spine, and snapped her a sharp salute. "Lieutenant Zach Lightman," I said. "Reporting for duty, ma'am."
"Lieutenant Alexis Larkin," she replied, returning the salute. "Ready to save the world."
I dropped my hand and took a step back.
"You look outstanding, Lieutenant."
"Why, thank you, Lieutenant," she said. "You don't look too shabby yourself."
She studied the rank on my uniform.
"So, I take it the Admiral decided not to court-martial your insubordinate ass?"
I shook my head. "He let me off with a warning." She shook her head.
"See what I mean?"
she said. "You're clearly getting special treatment." She gave me a shove. "Is your old man a senator or a mob boss or something?" I wasn't sure how to answer that, so I didn't.
"Where are they sending you?" I asked.
"Sapphire Station," she said. "That's the code name for another base like this one, located just outside Billings, Montana. How about you?" I handed her the printout of my orders that Vance had given to me. When she finally located my destination, her eyes went wide, and she looked back up at me.
"Moonbase Alpha?" she said. "It's real?"
"Apparently."
She shoved the sheet of paper back at me in disgust. "What a bunch of horse shit!" she said. "I get stationed in Montana, and you get to go to the fucking moon! That's real fair."
She gave me another playful shove.
"Maybe I need to start being insubordinate like you."
I knew she was joking, so I didn't respond. An awkward silence descended. Lex unsnapped her QCOM from the strap on her forearm.
"Hold out your arm for a second."
I did as she asked. She touched her QCOM to mine, and both devices beeped.
"Now I've got your number and you've got mine," she said. "We can stay in touch."
She pointed to the countdown clock on her QCOM and smiled. "We'll probably only be able to stay in touch for another 6 hours and 43 minutes, so it's no big deal." "Thank you," I said, staring down at her name on my own QCOM's display, and then at the countdown timer next to it.
"Wow, you're a popular guy," Lex said, staring down at her QCOM screen.
She tapped it a few times, then tilted it toward me again, and I saw the three names listed on my own contact list mirrored there. Arjang Dog, Alexis Larkin, and Ray Habishaw. Then she tapped the music icon, and I saw that she had somehow pulled all of the music off of my device, too.
"Hey, how did you do that?"
I said, making a half-hearted grab for her QCOM. She snatched it out of my reach.
"I was pissed when they hacked into my old phone, so I decided to try hacking theirs. It was shockingly easy," she smiled.
"They may have used alien technology in these things," she said. "But the software they installed to run it all was clearly created by humans. Overworked, underpaid programmers like me who take all kinds of shortcuts. The security protocols on the file sharing system are a total joke. It only took me about 5 minutes to jailbreak this thing." She tossed her QCOM behind her back with one hand, then caught it effortlessly with the other, keeping her eyes on me the whole time. Then she held it back up in front of me. "Access to the public phone network is still disabled,
so I wasn't able to call my grandma, she said. However, I did figure out how to enable admin privileges on the QCOM network. Now I can pull private data stored on another QCOM just by calling it or touching it with mine. Contacts, text messages, emails, everything.
But why would those features even be included in the software?
Why do you think? She said. So Big Brother can keep on spying on each of us right up to the bitter end. She grabbed my phone. Here, I'll jailbreak yours too. I handed my QCOM back to her, then watched as her thumbs danced across the keyboard on its display for a moment.
You're kind of amazing, I blurted out, because that was what I was thinking, and I'd recently been told the world was about to end. Did you know that?
She blushed, but didn't avert her gaze from my QCOM display.
Yeah, well, she said, playfully rolling her eyes. That's just, like, your opinion, man.
I laughed and moved a step closer to her. She didn't move away.
Listen, I said, as if she weren't quite obviously already doing so. I know we just met. But I just wanted to let you know that I wish we'd met each other a long time ago, under different circumstances. She smiled.
Don't go getting all mushy on me now, princess, she said, stepping back.
So long.
She turned as if to walk away.
Then she abruptly turned again, spinning back around on her heel, grabbed me by the lapels, and then she kissed me, right on the lips, with tongue and everything. When we both finally came up for air, Lex wrapped her arm around me in a fierce hug. Then she stepped back and jerked a thumb over her shoulder toward the lone shuttle on the opposite side of the bay.
That's my ride over there, I said. I think they're probably waiting on me.
Yeah, we should both get going.
Yes, we should. Neither of us moved.
Good luck, Lex, I said finally.
Give 'em hell, Zach, she replied, grinning.
Call me from the far side of the moon. Let me know if you spot any Decepticons or secret Nazi bases hidden up there.
Will do.
We saluted each other again. Then she hoisted her new EDA backpack and ran over to her shuttle. I watched until she disappeared inside and its doors hissed closed. A few seconds later, the shuttle lifted off and ascended through the narrow gap between the armored blast doors high above, which were now too warped and damaged to open all the way. Then Lex's shuttle tilted skyward and rocketed away out of sight. I took a deep breath, hoisted my own pack onto my shoulder, and turned to walk toward my own shuttle, wondering how long it would take to fly me to the moon.
14. As I approached the shuttle, I could hear several loud, overlapping voices coming through its open hatchway.
Why does everyone always automatically assume that Red Jive is a man?
A woman asked in a thick, Fargo-esque accent.
That's pretty damn sexist, if you ask me.
Yeah, a younger female voice chimed in. The Red Baroness might be a better nickname for her.
Female laughter followed. I paused a few yards from the shuttle and crouched, pretending to adjust the Velcro straps of my new EDA sneakers so that I could continue to eavesdrop.
People assume Red Jive is a guy because Red Five was a guy, a male voice replied.
He had some sort of East Coast accent that sounded equally thick to my Pacific Northwestern ears.
Hate to tell you, but the Red Baron was a dude too. Just like Maverick, Goose, Iceman, and every other ace fighter pilot in history.
You're aware that those are all fictional characters, right?
The younger woman asked, talking over the man's chuckling.
For your information, there have been female fighter pilots for over 100 years now. I wrote a report about it for school. A woman named Marie Marvink flew combat missions over France way back in World War I, and the Russians used female fighter pilots in World War II, and the U.S. military has had women fighter pilots since the 70s.
After a pregnant pause, the male voice responded with an annoyed, "Yeah, whatever." This was followed by another round of high-pitched laughter and some scattered applause. I took it as my cue and stood up, then mounted the shuttle's small retractable staircase.
The laughter died out as soon as the cabin's four occupants saw me appear in the open hatchway and turned to face me. I stood there for an awkward beat, letting them size me up, while I did the same to them. They were all dressed in newly pressed EDA flight officer uniforms like mine. To my immediate left sat a pretty middle-aged woman with tanned skin and dark hair and the name Lieutenant Wynn stitched onto her uniform. There was an empty seat to her right, while on her left